So, you know, I just could not help but see not only the parallels, but also how what seems to be unfolding in Gaza is even worse than what I saw in Bosnia.
And we have less than a minute left, but I'm wondering your perspective on how the U.S. media has been covering the war in Gaza.
It's been a real mixed bag, and it was a real mixed bag in Bosnia. You know, and we're all kind of captives of our experiences, and so I covered the war in Bosnia. I also covered other wars, so, you know, I may be talking too much about Bosnia, but I think it is relevant. In Bosnia, there was exceptionally good coverage, I think, and I'm biased on this, but I think, from the journalists who were on the ground, largely foreign journalists, but also a lot of Bosnian journalists, really good coverage of actually what was going on. But then in the foreign capitals, in Washington, D.C., but also London and France, France and Britain were very important elements of the international community at the time. The reporting was terrible because it reflected the kind of briefings that the journalists were getting from all their government sources and all the think tank people. And they were just saying, oh, it's a mess.
We have 15 seconds, Peter.
So we have the same problem now where there's a lot of bad coverage coming out of the capitals, such as Washington, although from the ground itself, reporting is quite excellent.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Peter Maas, journalist, former senior editor for The Intercept, author of Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War. We'll link to your latest piece in The Washington Post. He also covered U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq for The New York Times. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them, and not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 98.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I'm Al McFarlane. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarlane. Glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. Got a great program lined up for you today. We're going to have our friend and colleague, Coach Leah, talking about the WNBA draft and the Timberwolves dropping to third seed after the All-Star break. We're going to talk about Israel versus Iran and also talk about the latest on the Trump trial. Joining us today, partnering with me today, my colleague Ndugu Yusuf Mjini and Maestri Yoji Sena, who joins us from Bahia in Brazil. But before we do that, let's do some station business. Miguel is there. Miguel, how are you? This is still Pledge Week, right? Pledge program. Let's get some money in the door, right?
Yes, yes. This is week two of KFAI Spring Member Drive. And you know, yeah, we're getting some momentum here. We are just passing the $36,000 mark. And of course, we got plenty of room for more donations. We appreciate being community partners with The Conversation with Al McFarlane. It's a pleasure. Right now, I can't believe I'm on a YouTube channel. And so Al is sharing his followers, his audience with us. And of course, we are sharing our KFAI listeners with Al as well. And this, yeah, community partnerships right there. And for a long time. Al, how long have you been broadcasting with KFAI?
I think at least 30 years, but I can't remember, man. I really can't. It was in the 80s.
Wow. Wow.
What would that be? That might be 40 years.
Wow. I mean, yeah, if you want to round up, there you go. If you want to be fair, yeah. You want to round up. That's what it is. Yeah. But the secret to maintaining such great programming for so long is listener member contributions for community media for KFAI. So that's why we have membership drives in the fall and in the spring. And it's really the listener members and their financial support is what keeps us independent and what keeps us around for such a long time. And if you want to continue supporting that and you haven't had the chance yet, you can call 612-375-9030 if you want to talk to somebody. They can take care of your financial donation, or you can give online at kfai.org. and you can give that way. And yes, yes, thank you. Thank you for all of those that have given, and thank you to those who are about to give. Appreciate it.
And thanks to those who are joining us on our social media platforms, YouTube, LinkedIn, on Facebook, and Twitter. And we especially invite you, no matter where you are in the world, to support KFAI, support this program by going to KFAI.org and make a donation. We also want to thank those of you who have subscribed to our channel. Here's a big announcement. Drum roll, please. Last week, we crossed the 1,000 subscriber mark. So we've got 1,000 plus subscribers and heading to 2,000. And if you've not subscribed, you know what to do. Well, look, let's get into the program. Miguel, I'm going to call you back in a couple of times to keep the energy going, because we want to get people to take the step, think about it, want to do it, but then get up and do it. Make the phone call, go online, and make it happen for our KFAI Pledge Drive.
Thank you so much.
Okay?
Yep, thank
you. See you in a minute. Well, let me bring on Coach Leah first. Coach Leah, how are you doing? What, you know, women's sports in general on the mind of everybody in the world, but the whole sports, you know, business arrangement is sort of being renegotiated by the strength of women players and coaches. What's on your mind today?
Wow, and that is exactly right. This is such an amazing time for women in sports, for women's basketball, and primarily, you know, taking advantage of the momentum is what we're all trying to do at this time. And I include myself, because we've got, you know, we're on the heels of our Wellness, Wealth, and Winning weekend with Tall Girls United, an organization that myself and Sylvia Crawley Span, former WNBA coach and player and WNBA legend, we co-founded. And what we're seeing is that what we saw is that literally on the heels of our fashion show, the tip-off fashion show, we received calls from individuals that had players that were going to be invited to the draft in New York, wanting to know who the stylists were and who the designs were, designers for those tall fashions, so that they could rock the red, not the red carpet, but the orange carpet with those designs. And so we know for sure that Prissy Duck, which was one of our lines that we had in our fashion show, was at the draft. And so, you know, that those types of things are so so exciting. You know, it's so exciting to know that we are all interconnected in, the business of women's basketball and being seen. You know, we're just so grateful to be seen. Finally, as I exhale, because honestly, we have an amazing product and, something so, you know, a purist, I talk about this all the time, a purist that loves basketball, loves the women's game, for sure. So let's talk really quick about the draft. And of course, the number one pick for this year, 2024, was Iowa's Caitlin Clark. No surprise. Nobody was surprised. I mean, literally nobody was surprised. The Indiana team itself, the whole state of Indiana, started putting together promotional packages. The sales of their season tickets is astronomical. They're almost gone, you know, that type of thing. And so, and that's unheard of. That has never been the case, you know, since the inception of the WNBA. And so, you know, we're excited about that. You know, Caitlin Clark very humbly talks about that she stands on the shoulders, and she does a very intentional job of mentioning first Cheryl Swoopes, of mentioning first Candace Parker, of mentioning first, you know, these women who paved the way for her to even have this platform right now, even though the media, the mainstream media, is really trying to push her as the, you know, as the spokeswoman for, you know, the WNBA or for women's basketball or whatever. She knows herself that she stands on the shoulders of these other women that come, that have come before her. Dawn Staley, who she considers one of her idols, you know what I'm saying? And so even though they lost to South Carolina for the NCAA championship, you know, you'll see that Caitlin Clark is realizing that she's being pushed to the forefront, but she's also making sure intentionally that she makes mention of the shoulders that she stands on, which are the women that have come before her, African-American women, women that, you know, really paved the way for her to even have a platform.
Well, I have to give kudos to Coach Staley. She was so gracious and so magnificent in elevating Clark after the game, after Clark's, you know, the team's defeat. She took the time to thank personally Clark for what she has done to elevate women's athletics in general and women's basketball in particular, and wished her continued success in broadening the engagement and the presence and the popularity of women's sports, women's basketball in particular. She did a great job doing that.
She did. She did. And she, you know, and everybody will continue to make sure that the narrative is what it is. Caitlin made mention of, you know, Angel Reese. Angel Reese makes mention of Caitlin Clark, of Camila Cardosa, of, you know, everybody, Cameron Brink, you know, everybody is making sure that the narrative is what it needs to be. And in, even when journalists and others that are out here, you know, writing about and talking about what's going on with women's basketball, I'm really happy to see that everyone is in lockstep with making sure that the narrative is a correct narrative when it comes to what's going on right now. But at the same time, we're going to ride this wave. We are absolutely going to ride this wave because it's an exciting, very, very exciting time where, you know, and everybody can eat. You know, that's the thing, that's the important part of what's going on right now. Everybody can eat. And so, yeah, we're just happy to see that. So can I take a quick pivot? So I wanted to talk about where I saw that Caitlin Clark was on Saturday Night Live. And it was the, so when you guys get a chance, you know, go Google Saturday Night Live, Caitlin Clark, and in her being interviewed by Colin Jost and his name is escaping me right now.
And there, Michael Shea.
Michael Shea, absolutely. In that segment. And so it's the cutest thing. And she's doing just a really great job. You know, as we're watching her do the things that she's doing with the media, with television, and it, she's taking every opportunity to elevate everybody. And that's what we should be doing. You know what I'm saying? Even though it's kind of about her, it's really about the momentum of women's basketball and the momentum of women's sports as a whole. And so it's I'm loving it. I'm loving it. So get a chance. When you get a chance, definitely go check that out. So, yeah.
Camila Cardosa, Angel Reese.
So what an amazing opportunity that the two of them are going to have. USC, South Carolina's 6'7" center Camila Cardosa was the second pick of the WNBA draft this year, going to Chicago. And then Chicago did a last minute flip to trade for the 7th pick so that they could select Angel Reese. So very many of us that did mock drafts literally had the first 7 picks, the first even 8 picks correct. Many of us did. Very few that know what the teams needed and what type of fits would be for the player and for those picks, were surprised. And so that rarely ever happens. But this year, with all the superstars, and this year with the picks being so so specific, it was kind of easy to make those picks. But the fact that Chicago made sure to know that, you know what, Angel Reese is not going to make it to the 8th pick. We got to get that 7th one. So they made that switch right away. And now you're going to see Angel Reese and Camila Cardosa, who have been playing against each other in the SEC for the past 2 seasons, play together on one team. A fun comment that Camila Cardosa made during her press conference, her right after the pick. And she was saying, we like to try to see anybody get rebounds against us. That's what we want to know. Because both of them love to rebound. They love to rebound. And so, yeah, that was a lot of fun to see that. Yeah. So going to take another quick pivot if I can, and let's talk about our Minnesota Timberwolves.
Yeah.
Our beloved Minnesota Timberwolves. And so, again, I tell everybody, I am 1 degree of separation from everybody on the planet. Like, for sure, I really know I am. And each day as I live, I find out that that is a true belief of mine, that that is something to that I'm honored about. It's nothing to brag about. I'm just honored to know that there's 1 degree of separation. So now, the son of our own South Minneapolis, Dave Holmgren, who played for South High. Then he went on to play for the University of Minnesota, first 7-footer that I can remember coming out of the Twin Cities. His son is Chet Holmgren, that plays for the OKC, Oklahoma City Thunder. And they have knocked the Timberwolves out of the first place in the Western Division since All-Star break. What had happened was, for the first time in the history of the NBA, you had three teams with three identical records going into the second to the last game of the regular season. And so it was going, and it was OKC, it was Denver, and then it was our Timberwolves, right? And so the Timberwolves dropped two games. And so that dropped them to third place. Denver ended up being second place, and then now OKC, with their wins, is now the first place in the Western Conference going into the postseason and going to the playoffs. And so even though I'm a little sad that the Timberwolves couldn't maintain that first spot, the fact that they're third is still good, still a good placement. And they're playing out of their minds right now. I'm so excited to be able to check them out more during this postseason, because I've got a little bit of a break from focusing on women's basketball, so I'll be able to watch the Timberwolves in their pursuit of making it deep into the playoffs, and you know, hopefully maybe that, you know, that the championship, the world championship at the end. So, but speaking of Chet Holmgren, has anybody seen the commercial with AT&T with Chet Holmgren in it? And it's just the cutest thing. And if we can take a quick look at that, just a quick 30-second clip. You guys got to check it out.
Go for it.
AT&T just sent me a heads up on the best plan for me.
That's cool.
They know what a pro wants.
What a pro needs.
Whatever makes me happy.
Sets you free.
And I'm thanking you for knowing exactly what a pro wants, what a pro needs. Whatever makes me happy sets me free.
Good. A little bit flat. It'll get better.
AT&T provides proactive recommendations so you get what's right for you.
Yes, and I agree. It was a little flat, but it's going to get better.
Let me say to our listeners, we're not airing the commercial as a commercial. We're presenting it as a news story. This is news commentary, but I want to make sure that we don't violate any of our rules, because we're non-commercial. So please know that that was not a commercial. It was a look at, something that we think is noteworthy and newsworthy. And thank you, Coach Leah.
Absolutely. Definitely newsworthy, in the fact that we're having people from our own hometown being able to be featured, highlighted, and we have to continue to embrace the people from our hometown. Speaking of, I want to make sure that you guys join me with making a pledge to KFAI. I'm so grateful to be on this simulcast with KFAI. Lots and lots of fond memories of listening to KFAI back in the day, and so happy to see that we have this partnership. And I will be sending my pledge soon. And everybody, make sure you check out Coach Leah on Inside News, our sports page. A beautiful spread with Don's Daily, by the way. It was amazing.
Yeah. Coach Leah, thank you, my friend. We'll talk to you later, okay?
Very good. Bye-bye now.
We're going to come back and talk about Israel versus Iran and talk about President Trump. But before we do, let's bring Miguel back in. Miguel, that was a great conversation. Leah is so cool, you know, and she's on top of it, right? That's a view from the inside, you know, and it's a unique view, and it's an informed view of the change that's afoot in the whole world of sports.
Now,
here on KFAI, right here.
I've been really enjoying Coach Leah's segments for, especially the past, because this is obviously the high peak season for basketball, whether if it's college, men's, women's, and like the NBA, and even the WNBA with their draft day. Like,
I'm learning so much from her, just from me reading her columns and listening to her. I'm learning. I know that's the truth for me.
I'm so glad that, you know, out of the wide range of programming and topics that we cover here at KFAI, that there's even room for, you know, what's happening in our basketball world. Because, yeah, it involves us, you know, in the Twin Cities as well. I can't wait for next week's already. And if you're like me, if you're waiting for like next week's show or, you know, next week's content, I think that's a good example of how much you love KFAI. That's your intuition right there. And so if you haven't given to KFAI during our spring membership drive, this is the last week, we got a couple more days to go. But even after the last day on Wednesday, which is tomorrow, you can still give online at KFAI.org. But if you want to talk to somebody on the phones, you can call 612-375-9030 and they will walk you through the process.
Awesome. Thank you, Miguel. Well, you know what to do. Call the number and we'll get you signed up. And we thank you in advance for your support. Let me bring in my colleagues. Youssef Mjini is joining me from St. Paul, and Yoji Sena from Bahia in Salvador, right, in Brazil. So, brothers, good afternoon. Welcome once again. How are you doing? And Youssef, you're muted.
Good afternoon to the two of you as well. Yoji, Al.
I'm doing very well.
Good. Well, let's jump right in on the Israel versus Iran. Youssef, want to take a minute and just sort of give us, where are we now following, you know, the news and current events?
Well, the Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus was far more than saber rattling, but the saber rattling continues in the Mideast between Israel and Iran, and Israel has promised that they will retaliate in some form or fashion against the several hundred drones that were fired at them just in the past day or two. There are a number of side stories to the situation in the Middle East. Number one, we've surpassed 33,000 people killed in Gaza as a result of the Israeli Defense Force initiative to try and totally eradicate Hamas. Iran, on the other hand, is a country of almost 80-some million people, not a tiny, you know, Middle Eastern upshoot in the desert. They've got powerful military, armed forces, are working on a nuclear program, and need to be taken seriously. Netanyahu appears to be a lame duck and a lone duck. And many people have suggested that he is continuing the conflict because he is under charges for fraud and bribery and corruption. And the minute that he is no longer in office, he goes into the courtroom and faces an extended jail sentence. So for him, there are benefits. He's using the Trump excuse that you can convict a sitting prime minister or president, and wants to maintain the conflict. He indicated that he was going to open the gates of hell in Gaza, and that is exactly what he has done. We've seen protests all over the globe, the Golden Gate Bridge, Paris, Miami, New York, Chicago. And these are not necessarily pro-Palestinian protests. These are ceasefire protests that people are opposed to the carnage, to the deaths, to the damage that's taking place in Gaza, and the senseless killing of civilians, the most notable of which was the, Yoji, help me, was it the World Central Kitchen, where the seven or eight humanitarian aid workers were killed about a week ago after informing the Israeli Defense Force of their route and their caravan and being assured of safety. We had a similar incident over the weekend where one of the, I forget, is it the Red Crescent? That is their version of the Red Cross. They had gotten permission right. from IDF to go in and pick up a young boy in Gaza who was in critical condition and take him to where he could get satisfactory health care. And their vehicle was bombed and the occupants killed. So, and here's another piece that is often mentioned. More than 10,000 Jewish Americans have left the United States and returned or gone to Israel, where they enjoyed dual citizenship to fight for the Israeli Defense Forces and defend Israel. So there are American citizens, albeit joint citizens of the US and Israel, on the ground participating in the conflict that's taking place in Palestine. And the United States has indicated that they will not participate in any on-the-ground conflict between Israel and Iran, because clearly Biden cannot afford to get drawn into it during an election year, okay, with all of the campaigning going on. At the same time, the Speaker in the House of Representatives has had calls for his resignation because he has promised this week to bring up three bills dealing with aid to Ukraine, Israel, and the Sudan, of which we've heard very little international information of late. So you've got all of these things taking place. And my grandmother would say, the cauldron is beginning to boil. Okay, the temperature is rising. The conflict is becoming more tense. And the potential for armed conflict, for international conflict is increasing every day. And Israel has indicated that they intend to assassinate the leadership of Hamas, no matter which country that they are housed in, you know. And that's a pretty powerful statement, you know. And I think that there is more than enough evidence to call for a cessation or some type of serious negotiations to try and end the senseless death, the starvation, the lack of healthcare, water, food, medicine. And the projections are that one half of the people in Gaza will starve before July 1st under the current conditions. And with the killing of the World Central Kitchen humanitarian aid workers who have served almost 1.5 million meals to people starving in Gaza. Many of the aid organizations, the international humanitarian organizations, have pulled out until such time that they can absolutely guarantee the safety of their volunteers and aid workers who are on the battle lines trying to provide health care, to trying to provide food, water, medicine, and support to civilians in Palestine. So very, very dangerous situation. And I want to remind us that there are people who practice the Hebrew faith, 90% of whom are people of color. There are Israeli citizens, citizens of Israel, who do not necessarily support the positions of the Zionist Netanyahu government. And then there is the Netanyahu machine that is hell-bent on warfare and destruction. So we need to be careful not to lump all people who practice the Hebrew faith, all Israeli citizens, or all people of good faith and good intentions across the planet when we have this conversation. We're talking about the actions of a right-wing Israeli Zionist government, okay, that many people in Israel and in Palestine and around the world take exception to. We're talking about unnecessary death and carnage of women, children, civilians. And we're talking about the potential for armed conflict escalating in the Middle East that could cost, you know, countless tens of thousands of more lives before this situation is brought to an end. So It's a very complicated and complex situation. Yes, it does involve us because we've got young U.S. servicemen who are stationed with American forces, not in Israel, Palestine, or Gaza, but in the Middle East, in that area, in the Navy, and we've got 83 military bases in Africa that are just a hop, skip, mm-hmm. jump away from the Middle East. So it's a very, very dangerous and complicated situation now, Yoji, and we just have to hope and pray for some type of sensible resolution that is mutually beneficial for all sides.
Yoji, how does it look from where you stand in Bahia? What's the conversation?
Well,
what's the Yoji?
The relevance as there is in the U.S., you know, it's one more of the things that's happening in the world. But the Israeli ambassador yesterday gave an interview protesting for the lack of condemnation from the Brazilian government of the actions. So, you know, my sense is that, not my sense, but seems to be clear, that the Brazilian government in this case is not supporting Israel, you know, and because historically the line of action of the Brazilian diplomacy has been always one of certain kind of neutrality and giving more weight to diplomatic negotiations to issues. And clearly, being Netanyahu, an ally, one of the greatest allies of Bolsonaro, we would assume that the position of Brazil also, it is in certain way ambiguous in relationship to Israel. And also because we do have significant business interests in Iran and not in this case, but Russia too. So the volume of business that is conducted between those countries are bigger between Iran and Brazil than with Israel. Even though we do have a somehow large Jewish population, mainly in the city of São Paulo and Rio, here we still don't have this sophistication in the sense of analyze those conflicts and how it would repercut in Brazil. You know, we got to a position that this war or this conflict is getting already out of hand. You know, one thing that I always keep in mind when we talk about Iran and the demonization that is done by the West of Iran, I always remember that this Iran that we talk Persian, so it's an ancient millennial, unconquered, uncolonized country, as was is China and others. So, and also in the Middle East, when I talk to people, there is also in Brazil a large Palestinian population, large Lebanese, entire towns, areas that are Palestinians here, principally in the south border of Uruguay and Paraguay. So for us, it's clear which side to put ourselves, you know, presents, you know, the Western world that is in certain invading. And I mentioned this stuff of the Persians, and so the Palestinians, when I talk to them, and all people from that area that lives here, is always present. And when I also mentioned Iran being Persia, this sense of conflicts. This conflict has been happening almost, you know, forever. You know, the people from the Middle Eastern, the one that profess the face of Muhammad, the memory of the Crusades is still very latent, where to us is just an anecdote far past.
Yeah.
You know. And also this posture of Iran, it is a posture that also them are in certain way trying to reclaim this significance in the world, you know. So it's one of the greatest empire. It's one of the roots of many things that we do in the world today, in the Western world. Many is the source of culture, of habits, of religion. People even say that Judaism certainly come from Persia, right? This relationship with the cult of Mazda and Mizra.
And the Coptic faith, Yoji.
Yeah. And the Coptic, you mentioned Egypt, right? So these are ancient cultures that are older than the European cultures, and older, of course, than the so, what I read today, for example, it is that in certain way, the Israel and the U.S. is claiming that that the barrage of drones and missiles of Iran was a failure. But what the view that I today, it is in certain way that the Iranians, they really didn't want to cause a big issue. They send subsonic missiles that took hours. They warned the Turkish 72 hours before that
in advance. They would
launch the attack in advance. Mm-hmm. And so they was kind of a salvo of watch out, you know, because probably if they would want to create more damage or really wreak havoc in the Middle Eastern, they would send their supersonic missiles and they would summon to participate. Hezbollah has hundreds of thousands of missiles next door to Israel. It would take seconds to arrive to Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. So it's in a certain way...
Yoji. Let me ask you, Yoji. I felt like the Iranian response rate was performative. It was intended to save face for them in the international arena to tell their people that we have acted on behalf of those of our citizens and leaders who were destroyed in the Israeli attack in Syria. And I think that what you're saying is that they had no intention of inflicting escalatory, you know, damage or damage that would encourage and demand escalation, but rather were warning in a very public way what was about to happen in a way that amounts to a performance that allowed, you know, the allies, the US, Britain.
At least not yet, okay?
Yeah. I'm just wondering, you know, what do we see? And do you see both?
I'm sorry,
it's intermittent transmission. But the Persians has issues with the Jews for a while. It's not in this century, nonetheless, it's almost biblical. So they was a performative strike to, as you say, to maybe to domestic audience or to the Middle Eastern audience that they would not be quiet. But in the sense that are saying that Iran is Persian, we also, it seems many times when the analyst talks about or news are produced or reports are produced about the Israelis and the Jewish state, I feel there is a lack of understanding what's the nature of being Jewish. So the most famous Jewish person was the one who offered this, the other cheek, right? And that's not the culture. They are not about forgiveness. It's like if you step on the toes, they're going to step on your toes and your feet and your hand and your head too. That is the nature of their, the ethos of being Jewish. You know, if they feel injustice done to them, they go over, they will take revenge multiplied.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's clearly the position of the Netanyahu government.
Exactly. He's expected him, the Israeli, to be in this way. And we should expect that they're going to do something also now. As you guys should have been noticing, they try to draw the American, you know, to do their you know, the fight for them.
We should also point out that Netanyahu's actions are intended beneath the surface to provide support for the candidacy of Donald Trump. Because we know about the tension between Biden and Netanyahu, and that tension is increasing every day, where Biden is telling him, look, think very carefully. You know, we're not automatically just going to jump in, and the pressure is building on...
And that's a different posture of Biden, right? Because always
the pressure is building on Biden to make the military aid to Israel conditional, because the assault weapons that the United States is shipping to Israel, you know who they're being given to? The settlers, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Everyday Israeli citizens are receiving assault weapons from the United States through the Israeli International Defense, Israeli Defense Force. And so there's campaign issues of the U.S. presidency, there's international issues, you don't drop a 500-pound bomb and level an embassy in a sovereign country like Israel did of the Iranian embassy in Damascus and leveled that embassy to the ground without anticipating some warning or some potential for negative feedback as a consequence. And Israel has been playing the Israeli government, the Israeli Defense Force has been playing fast and loose in terms of assassinations and death squads and bombings all over the Middle East that many people hope are not going to come back to haunt them in some form or fashion that result in an escalated conflict in the Middle East. It's a very...
And having Donald Trump elected, they're going to run free, the Israelis, or the Netanyahu government. You know, he's buying time betting that Trump will be elected.
With conflict, yeah.
Yeah.
With conflict.
Well, that's a great survival. Way to say. Let's go into the next topic. But before we do, Miguel, if you're there, let's take a minute to do a pledge rap. We'll talk about Donald Trump and what this thing all means. Bring Miguel in again, if you would. Here we go.
Hey
Miguel. Let's extend the invitation one more time. We want people to support this conversation. You know, and the people that are watching online on YouTube or LinkedIn or Twitter, we'd love to have you engaged in the conversation. Just drop a post in the comments section. If nothing else, say hello and say where you're watching from. We'd like to know that. But we also invite you to join our audiences here on the live radio on 90.3 FM and 90.3.org or KFAI.org. That's global as well. To be a supporter of this station, you can do it by becoming a member. How does that work, Miguel?
Oh, if you want to talk to somebody about being a member and hear about all the different levels that you can give and then what you can get for being a member as well, because we got all sorts of cool merch like hats, t-shirts, postcards, stickers. at many different levels and sets. So no matter what you can give, there'll be something for you there. And if you want to talk to somebody about it, you can call 612-375-9030. Or if you have a little bit of time later today, you can go to KFAI.org. And, yeah, we can show you all the merch that's there on our website. And you can give online there. Thank you to all of those who have given, like Ryan, who just gave at the top of the hour. Thank you so much, Ryan. And thank you so much for sharing your audience with our audience as well. And especially covering the issues that you are covering as well. Yeah. Coming from local perspectives and just speaking about what's happening over there is and how it affects us and where are we complicit, basically. So really, thank you for having this conversation on The Conversation.
And that's a big issue to talk about that. You know, Youssef, one of the things that you said that I wanted to call attention to before we pivot is you mentioned that, I think you said 30,000 or some thousand U.S. citizens have gone to Israel to fight with the IDF.
10,000.
Yeah. And so the question I have is, does our country allow people to go to other countries? Apparently, if that's the case, it's cleared and authorized. What's the mechanism that allows a person to have dual citizenship and to freely serve under a different flag without renouncing his or her support for the American government and American flag? And I raised the question because this is where a lot of young Somalis have been prosecuted for attempting or stating that they intended to go to the Middle East to join jihad movements. Sure. So can Indian Americans, for example, can Somali Americans, for example, can Latino Americans who maybe have an issue with the challenges in Central America or South America, can they all freely support governments, formal military operations in other countries, the way we've seen is happening with the 10,000 people who've left this country to support and join the IDF in Israel? Do you know the answer to that, Youssef, at all?
That figure was closer to October 7th than it was to today. We have no idea and no current reports of how many individuals have done that, Al. And Israel is one of the few countries that provides automatic citizenship to any Jewish person anywhere on the planet. So we have been allowing it. Now, the pretense or the justification that people use for going there and what they actually wind up doing are two different things, okay? Mm-hmm. Because people can get a passport and claim they're on vacation or visiting or, you know, seeing sex relatives, whatever they want to do. We have not allowed that. But when we hear about Americans losing their lives in the conflict in Palestine, one has to wonder, are these Americans with dual citizenship? You know, when we hear it about hostages, we hear it about people losing their lives, people in the Israeli Defense Force. Are these Jewish Americans who have dual citizenship? Or are these, you know, and forgive the terminology, are these wholly American citizens who happen to be there and get caught up in the conflict, whether they're humanitarian aid workers or religious? Sure. People or what, but we have allowed it, and we have looked the other way or winked and nodded or however you want to put this in context, and I am unaware of anyone who has been prosecuted similar to the Somali youth for publicly.
Well, let me put that out to those who are watching online or hearing this online. If somebody there has a comment or gives us some information about what our country's policy is about American citizens serving under and under foreign government flags, love to hear that. Let's use this, though, to pivot, because we want to talk about this is day two of the jury selection in Trump's historic hush money trial. And I've got up a article by CNN's Lauren Devalier and Jeremy Herb. This is a story filed a few minutes ago, April 16th, at about an hour ago, I think. but you know, it gives you an update. Today is the second day of jury selection. Trump is in the Manhattan courtroom as jury selection continues in his hush money criminal trial. Prosecutors and Trump's lawyers questioned 18 potential jurors on whether they can be unbiased. Both parties will now consider which jurors they want to dismiss if they don't believe they can render a verdict fairly.
And half of them have been dismissed because they indicated
already. They have a pool of 96, I think.
Yeah.
Pool of 96, and half of those are gone already. They're looking for a panel of 12 New Yorkers and six alternates that will ultimately be selected. What are you guys hearing about, and what's the significance of this trial, given that we're also in the high season for the political election?
Well, there's 34 felony counts, okay, of lying about personal wealth on applications on the one hand, and then lying on it again in the opposite direction when it came to taxes or paying his fair share, overvaluing and then devaluing. Melania Trump told her former press secretary, who wrote a book about the ins and goings of the White House and the First Lady, says that Melania Trump has indicated that this trial could be a game breaker, that it could cost Trump the election. And she has said that his dealings with a former porn star, Stormy Daniels, is Trump's problem, her husband's problem, not hers. And she was embarrassed and dismayed and distanced herself from her husband when this was in the headlines. And she stated that, you know, this could cost him the election if he is convicted, found guilty.
What are you hearing, Yoji? What are you hearing? And how's Brazil? And how's the global South looking at what's happening in New York?
Yeah, Brazil, significant attention to the trial. And in certain way, it is almost like is causing a feeling, unique feeling of superiority about our country towards the United States, how we've been resolving the conflict with the ex-president that's highly tendentious to the right wing. So it seems that in Brazil, the justice has been more swift and serious. And to us in the media, seems more that the American justice system, it's bending or is being influenced by Trump or giving him certain immunity. So he wouldn't be running, if he's in Brazil, he wouldn't be running to presidency again. Like Bolsonaro is already barred from any elected position until 2030, right? Yeah. And he's in really in hot trouble. I don't know if you got during Carnival, he preventively went to spend a weekend in the Hungary embassy because he was expecting to be jailed. You know, when they took his so it seems in this case that the justice here is a little bit more just.
It took
but
a lot of
yeah
longer,
we
too.
Yeah yeah
like
was kind of hilarious, but I think here the sense where certainly people are expecting him to be convicted, but they are kind of almost convinced that he won't.
One important signal was that yesterday Trump indicated that, or over the weekend, he wanted thousands and thousands of his hordes and supporters to show up in front of the trial and raise hell. And he said if they didn't, that all hell was going to break loose. In reality, only a handful of his supporters showed up. There was a small caravan of a few vehicles with flags and insignias, and there were as many protesters, anti-Trump protesters, as there were supporters on opposite sides of the street in front of the courthouse. So his ability to, he was hoping to draw a crowd the size of the January 6th insurrection and got a handful of people who stood on the sidewalk and didn't even block traffic. So,
well, you know, anybody that was in the January 6th knows better now Sent them to show up because they're in jail. Yeah.
A thousand of them went to jail. Yeah. But hey, you can't make this stuff up.
So what does it mean, Trump?
Yeah, it is.
Yusuf, what does it mean for the African American community as part of and the role we play in shaping, reshaping, redirecting this broad enterprise of governance in this country? And what does it mean for us internally in terms of how we work with each other to figure out, you know, ways to build on our desire for freedom and sustainability and dignity? Now,
it is perplexing because the last time Trump ran, 12% of Black males supported him. Mm. And that number has only increased in the interim. And I'm anxious to have our leading academic researchers and social critics and analysts really take a deep dive and help me understand some of that, because I clearly cannot explain it. Okay, I mean, there are the simple barbershop explanations, but I think that they don't really do justice to the phenomenon the division within the United States, the polarity has actually taken root within our own community. Mm-hmm. Is a fascinating item in and of itself, and may be worth some discussion at some point about how Black Republicans believe that this man is the savior of humanity. You know, I need somebody to throw me a life preserver, because somebody's putting something in the script in the movie that wasn't in the script, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But a lot of people are very passionate about that. There's a lot of the polarity and the division in the United States has never been greater since the OJ trial. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they had to trot him out and refuse to bury him so they could put him on parade even in death, you know, to satisfy some of the lingering angst that that OJ contributed to. But these folks are real, and they reproduce too. So help me.
Yogi, what do you think?
Well, listen, this polarization right now, I think it's here too. It's unbearable in Argentina, but I notice here that's similar to the sentiment in the U.S. is that the left camp, many Black people here, as in the U.S., feels that the lobbies that generally summon us during elections for support and everything, after they are elected, they forget us. So it's like they take the left take Black people for granted, because we were oppressed or are oppressed. They think with their discourse we gonna mindlessly support them. And there is the minutia, and that is in the minutia that some of the Black population, for a reason or the other, they tend to go to the right or to those bravados, because it would make sense why serves in the American army too, right? We don't question that, because maybe. And is when you say Black people is not a monolithic block that thinks and acts all the time in the same way.
True. History.
And that's what's expected. Yeah. And from the right and from the left. Right. So there is several motivations why there is this 12% of Black males that, because many Black people do embrace the values of Eurocentrism. Many Black people embrace, sometimes and sometimes unconsciously, they are embracing or replicating, right? Yep. When they think about wealth only, accumulation, display of power. I think it's normal, you know, that there is, even though can irks me a little bit, but is expecting. It's like here in Brazil, in Bahia, right?
About 10 seconds.
We are 80-90% of the population. That is never a black governor. All now, here's election years too. All the candidates, the majority, it is the Brazilian version of white, semi-whites, you know. So, we
drop it there, Yoji. Thank you, my friend, Ndugu, Youssef, and Jimmy.
Thank you.
I'm Robert Carlin. We'll see you next time. Take care. Bye-bye.
Stay safe.
Yes.